Morning, Bob. How are you?
Let's call the meeting to order. We have a quorum, so I'm going to start out with Laura. Our page, I forgot yesterday because I didn't see her running around at the end, but why don't you come up to the microphone and introduce yourself? This is our page. I don't know if she's going to be a permanent page, but she's here for us now.
Thank you. Laura Schroeder. I'm not sure if I'll be here long, but it's a pleasure being here today.
Thank you. Thank you for all your hard work.
Thanks.
And Secretary Simon, you can start whenever you wish.
Great. Well, Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. To those of you who are either new to the legislature or new to the committee, welcome to the committee. I know this is the second meeting of the committee, not the first. I actually served on this committee alongside many of you when I was in the legislature, and it's really a great committee. It's a great cross-section of state government, and I think you'll find it very helpful and very useful. I'm not here alone. I'm here alone sitting up here right now, but I have a supporting cast, several people there in the audience from our office who are ready and willing and able to handle any real specific questions you have. If you want to take a deep dive into a particular area, we can talk about that. But my sense of this from you, Mr. Chair, and others is that you want sort of a general overview of what it is that we do. And so I think maybe that's the best place to start, is to just go right into a broad overview of our office. As you can see, the Office of Secretary of State is broken into four divisions: elections, safe at home, business services, and administration. And I think it's fair to say that when or if people think of the Office of Secretary of State, they probably first usually think about the elections function. That's what gets the most attention. That's what tends to be most newsworthy, particularly in election years around election time, so that's understandable. But as you can see here, that's not the lion's share of the office in terms of resources. The lion's share, the biggest part, over 50% among the four areas, is the business services area, and the elections division is about one-third of the office or so. And then, of course, we also have administration and the Safe at Home program, which I'll describe in a few moments. So the business services division of the office provides many services to Minnesotans, especially those within the business community, business owners, small business owners in particular. We work a lot with chambers of commerce, economic development authorities, and others. We like to say that we're the welcome mat for businesses in Minnesota, and many of you know from personal experience why and how this is true. Most often, when a business, the first thing that a business will do when it starts is not to get a license, not to get a permit, not to get a tax ID number, not to get workers' comp insurance or whatever else. It's to file the actual entity, ABC Inc., XYZ Corporation, whatever it is, and that's done with our office. So we're often the very first point of contact for any business of any kind and any size in Minnesota. So we've really worked hard to improve the efficiency of the Business Services Division over the years to increase convenience for business owners through the use of online and walk-in services, including business name filings, searches, filing articles and renewals, articles of incorporation, amendments for all businesses and nonprofit organizations, and ordering various copies and certificates. We also record documents filed under the Uniform Commercial Code, or UCC, regarding collateral pledged to secure loans. We administer what's called the CNS, the Central Notification System for Farm Product Liens, and we file and maintain statewide federal tax liens as well. So, view from 30,000 feet. In 2018, there were over 70,000 new business filings. This was an all-time high for our office. That's new business filings. Total business filings, as you can see, are creeping up towards 500,000. And I got to say, I'm very proud of the staff in our office and the Business Services Division. They work very hard to ensure that starting a business is as easy as possible in Minnesota from a technical standpoint, and same with maintaining a business in Minnesota, because virtually every entity in Minnesota doesn't just have to file initially, but as some of you know from personal experience, has to renew every year with our office as well. And so handling those transactions it takes a lot of people power and a lot of bandwidth. So one of the things that we've tried to do over the last few years is figure out ways that we can really add value to businesses and to the business community. How can we play a role? You know, I can't do and we can't do what all of you do. I don't have a vote anymore like I once did on transportation or regulatory policy or tax policy. We can't do that. We can't touch that. But what we can do is we can make things easier from a technical standpoint and provide some value, some information, some data that might be really useful to businesses. And I just wanted to highlight one of these for you, one that we're particularly excited about and that you may have heard about. We call it the Minnesota Business Snapshot. We work on this with St. Cloud State University. We have a partnership with them where they help us track and summarize and sort of package the data. And here's what it is. This was an idea that originally came to me from a military veteran and someone I had worked with actually on this committee when I was in the legislature. And he approached me early on and he said, hey, I've always wondered something. I was brand new. And he said, in this job, and he said, why is it that there isn't some registry or list of veteran-owned businesses? I'm a veteran. I'd like to know who they are. I might want to collaborate with them. I want to patronize their businesses, maybe. But I don't know who they are. Yeah, they're dribs and drabs and spots of it, but couldn't you include a box on your forms, either online or in paper, where someone could self-identify and check the box and say, yes, I'm certifying that I'm a veteran-owned business? I said, good question. Let me look into it. So we looked into it. The answer was no. No one had ever done that. But that then opened up some other possibilities. Is there any other kind of information that we want to ask of people either coming into that welcome mat or returning annually to renew? What kinds of questions might we ask people on a voluntary basis that might, in an accumulated level, provide some value to people? Totally voluntary. It's not required. And so I'll fast forward through several steps, but we decided to come up with this thing called the Minnesota Business Snapshot. It's totally voluntary, and we have big, bold disclaimer language that the lawyers have vetted, so no one is somehow tricked into believing this is mandatory or part of the filing process, because it isn't. And we came up with a limited number of questions, and we put it out there, both online and in print. And the vast majority now, and some of you personally I know, do this online and not on paper, but of course we provide both. And there's been a great response from business filers. We have more than 300,000 responses. 300,000 who have responded to some or all of the questions. If you know anything about survey work, which I didn't going into this, if you get 5 or 10% response rate on a survey of any kind, that's considered really good. This is a huge percentage. Over 60% of new filers, new businesses, are responding to either 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 of the 5 questions, which we find really amazing. And we work, as I said, with St. Cloud State University to make this sort of digestible, the information with reporting and so forth. By the way, we also work with St. Cloud State. This is not on a slide in the interest of brevity, but we also work them on a separate side project, which is quarterly economic reports by region. So we chop the state up into 6 regions, and then quarterly we do economic reports with St. Cloud State where we combine data from our office about who's filing what kinds of businesses, with other economic data on consumer prices or on jobless claims or on housing prices and things like that, and come up with actual economic projections and predictions for given regions. So that's 6 regions, 4 reports. These are free. They're on our website. You can find them. So that's another project not listed here that we do with St. Cloud State. So what were the 5 questions? Well, and how do we come up with them? Well, we went to a lot of chambers, both the state chamber and local chambers around the state with geographic balance, and we talked to other folks in the business media community and said, if you could ask any 5 questions of a business either renewing a filing in Minnesota or brand new to Minnesota or brand new to the business community, if they came in and said, yep, I'm filing my LLC or my business corporation either for the first time or for the umpteenth time, what are the 5 questions? And I personally had the feeling, and others did too, that we want to keep it to 5. One handful. We're all surveyed to death. We get pop-ups. We get stuff in the mail. If you have a 50-question survey or a 20-question survey, people's eyes will glaze over. But if you make it really quick, simple, something you could do in 2 minutes, not too intrusive, that it could really work. And so the 5 that we came up with in consultation with folks that I just mentioned are these. I'm going to go a little out of order. But the first one is, what are you? You know, there's nothing under state law that says you've got to say that when you file a business. You just have to say the name and the address, and the name often doesn't tell you what it is. If it's ABC Inc., how are we supposed to know, is that a restaurant? Is that a factory? Is that a service station? What is that? So this is an opportunity, again, totally voluntary. They can tell us no, and I don't care to answer, or none of your business. But if they care to, they can answer what the business actually is. The second question is a number of employees within broad ranges. It's something like 0 to 5, 6 to 50, 50 to 200, something like that. There's a drop-down menu. The third one is self-identification of a member of a specific community. This is the veteran question that started it all. Are you, and then it has all the federal categories. There are only a few. Are you veteran-owned, woman-owned business, disability-owned, and so forth? Revenues, again, broad categories. This is not a tax audit. This is just very broad brushstrokes within broad categories. And the final one, which I never would have thought of, but some in the business community said, you know, you're going to want to ask this question, is, are you full-time or part-time? The example I sometimes use is my sister used to have a wedding cake business on the side. It's not what she does for a living. She's a good baker. People got wind of it and wanted her to do their weddings. And she did it just out of her own kitchen, and she filed. And you'd want to know if you were a Chamber of Commerce recruiting members, if you were an economic development authority in a particular town, if you were a business publication, if you were a vendor. You'd want to know, is this a bricks and mortar or potential bricks and mortar concern, or is this my sister in her kitchen? Save you a lot of time and aggravation. And so we ask that question, are you full-time or part-time? A lot of people have a hobby business or a consultancy on the side, and you'd want to know that. So those are the five questions. As I said, over 60% response rate, and it's something that we're really happy with. And incidentally, in case you're wondering on behalf of yourself or your constituents, this now, all this data from 300,000 respondents is now available to the public. And for a very low cost. We wish we could give it away for free, but based on state statutes, we have to charge for it, but we only have to charge, you know, a minimal amount. So if you want, or any of your constituents want, the entire database, all 300,000 responses in electronic form, so they could be filtered and sorted and ordered and searched electronically, it's $100. If you want anything less than 100%, it's $35. That's it. So you may have a chamber or an economic development authority or an individual, just a constituent, that says, you know, all things being equal, I'd like to patronize veteran-owned businesses. I'd love a list of who they are in my area. That's $35. Or you have an economic development authority that says, I don't need all this information. I just want these 20 zip codes, or I just want these 30 cities. You can search by city, by zip code, all of that stuff. So it's a service that we provide. It's brand new. We're excited about it, the possibilities, and we're eager for your and others' feedback. We're totally willing to swap out questions over time. If you think one of those should fall off the list and another come on, we're sort of wanting to keep it at 5. I think once you go to 6, it's easy how to see you get to 10 and then 20, and then the participation rate goes down because who wants to do a 20-question survey? So it's something we're proud of, and we hope will generate even more interest in the future. I know this isn't a budget overview, Mr. Chair, and I've been advised not to get into the weeds on numbers, but I just wanted to give you an overview. One of the things we're proud of is just institutionally over time, this is a profit center for the state, the Office of Secretary of State. There aren't too many agencies, you'll find out, that can say that. I think the Department of Commerce is one. There may be a few others in state government. We make money for the state. So if you pay for everything in our office, every last paper, person, paperclip, whatever, at the end of the day, we make $22 million more than we cost per biennium. And we only cost, out of the general fund, about $13 million. That's what makes it particularly interesting. I mean, if you were Department of Human Services and you're a multi-billion dollar agency and you make $22 million, yeah, that's nice. If you only cost $13-something million in general fund allocation and you make $22 million, that's a lot better. So I just think that's something to think about because of the fees we generate, in particular on the business side.
And Secretary Simon, I think Representative Hertaus had a question before we go on to the election portion.
Sure.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Secretary Simon, you mentioned about the services to businesses, and I'm a little concerned about the security of it. I came to your office last year on an issue, and my memory is a little dim exactly how it all played out, but the bottom line was is there's really no prohibition or inability of anybody to re-register an existing company and change the address and change the contact person, and they have no affiliation with that business. And this happened to a constituent of mine. And so if you require to have and maintain good standing with the state of Minnesota, and businesses need to register, then I think it's only appropriate that you have some type of password or some type of security that only allows the actual business that owns that name and those business entities to re-register their company. I don't know what the motive was for this, whether it was intentional fraud to be able to take out loans in the name of another company or other securitization or even real estate transactions. But this is a grave concern, and I was told by your office that we couldn't, that you couldn't do anything about it, and that business had to suffer with that with the remainder of the year until the next registration because there was no way to fix it, that it required a statutory change or some type of legislative action. So I'd like to follow up with you on that, but the Secretary of State's office should be able to provide that level of security if you are requiring these things to be happening in terms of maintaining annual registrations. And the second comment I'd like to make about what you just said about this being a revenue producer for the state of Minnesota, I don't think that's a good thing. I think you should only be charging the fees that are relevant to cover the cost of the service. And to be extracting money from the business community or others and to be deposited in a general fund for other use is really, I think, not the function of government. We've passed laws in this legislature in the past limiting fees and license renewals to the cost of actually administrating that. It's no different than building permits. Cities were using that as a way to generate revenue for the city, but it should only be the actual cost of the service. So if you're collecting twice what it costs to run this office, that would suggest to me that you ought to be cutting your fees in half.
Representative Simon.
Thank you.
Senator Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hertaus. Points well taken. Let me take the second one first as to the fees. Yeah, you all impose those fees. Those are statutory fees. There are some fees that are discretionary with us. We haven't raised them one penny in the last 4 years. Not one fee, one penny. So those are statutory fees. Those are set by the legislature. And I can't remember, Mr. Black might know, the last time those fees were raised or changed. Mr. Black, you want? Pardon me? 1989, I'm told. So it's not a question of someone trying to, you know, raise more fees than things cost. That's all with all of you. You impose those fees. So I'm just telling you, the fees that we are told to charge and do charge generate more money than we cost as an office. Oh, and as to the first issue, yes, that has generated your issue on the security. That is a national issue, believe me, and that has generated some intense discussion. I'm happy to talk with you more about it offline. Mr. Black is nodding. Some other folks from our office are nodding as well. This plays in with the entire cybersecurity issue, not just on the business side, but on the election side as well, whether it's imposing multi-factor authentication, whether it's redoing some of the databases. There might be some statutory changes that are necessary. Mr. Black, I think, looking over your shoulder there, I think that's correct. So that's something that I'm happy to work with you on, and it is a concern. I think you're right about that.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, since we're in the kind of wrapping up the business section, question for you on relations to that. You spoke about your agency being a people-powered organization with a certain bandwidth to perform the services you do. Can you speak briefly to the level of compliance with your business filing requirements?
The level of compliance?
Yes, sir.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you. Members, I'm just trying to understand the question. You mean those filing with our office, the level of?
Yeah, what kind of checks and balances you would have in place to ensure that what the information being provided is truthful and accurate?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So what if someone files with our office and they're just wrong or they're perpetrating a fraud?
Correct.
So we have a lot of partners that we work with, whether it's in the Enforcement Division in the Department of Revenue, Enforcement Division in the Department of Commerce, law enforcement itself. That has come up from time to time when someone's just perpetrating a fraud. But the interesting thing about our office, I mean, what we tend to say in our office and other secretaries have said before me is our office does not have guns and badges. We're not an enforcement agency. We take in, on the business side at least, we take in this information, but we don't have power vested in us to compel anyone to do anything or to go after someone who perpetrates a fraud. But we do regularly work with people who do have that authority in the agencies I just mentioned and others.
Thank you, Secretary.
Yeah.
Secretary Simon, any other questions that Representative Hewitt?
Mr. Chair, Secretary Simon, would it make sense, and I'm just looking at this since you've been in the Secretary's position, Business filings have steadily increased over the years.
Yes.
So the fees would definitely go up with that, and so without an adjustment on the fees, we're seeing a surplus somewhat, right?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, yes. I mean, part of this is just more people are doing stuff with our office. More people are transacting business. And I should say, a big spike came after the Great Recession. If you look at the charts, I don't think they're in your materials, there was a big spike in business filings, you might think paradoxically, at the time in 08, 09, and 10. Why? Because a lot of people were being laid off from existing bigger businesses and going out on their own, hanging out their own shingle. That was their recourse. And so there was a big spike in the number of business filings at that time. So that is an important part of the story in the last decade.
Mr. Chair, we're
Representative Hewitt.
And Secretary Simon, would it, is there any breakdown to, are these S-Corps, C-Corps, or individual proprietors?
Representative, or Senator, Secretary Simon, it's early.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, yes, I would say what tends to predominate over the last 15 years are LLCs. If there's one trend, if there's one takeaway over the last 15 or 20 years, it's the explosion of LLCs at the expense of other entities.
No further questions. Secretary Simon, you can proceed with the rest of your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pivoting over to the election side, which is probably the best known part of the portfolio of the office, we serve as the Chief Elections Administrator of Minnesota, so we work a lot with counties, cities, and townships to put on our elections in Minnesota. And we do that while maintaining the highest voter participation in the U.S. We've made important investments in democracy over the years, both in terms of the laws we pass, financial contributions, but there's a lot more to be done to make sure that we invest in democracy in the near term. One of the things my office does is operate and maintain SVRS. Some of you are familiar with this. I think you'll be more familiar with it in the coming days and weeks, the statewide voter registration system, which is what it sounds like. It's the database, sort of the master database of all Minnesota voters and really the backbone of the election system, and it does a lot. It's about more than just voter registration, and it's been asked to do a lot. It was built in 2004 with over $6 million of federal and state funds, and the election division in the office also certifies voting systems, accepts candidate filings, as you all know from personal experience, for federal and state offices, trains local election officials, and conducts most recounts. Why most? We only are in the space where there's a jurisdiction that crosses a county line, if it crosses a border. So if it's a multi-county recount for whatever office, we're involved. If it's contained within an office or within a county, we're not involved. That's the simple simple breakdown. Just to give you some context, there are more than 2,000 township elections annually, 900 city elections on a two-year cycle, 300 school district elections on a two-year cycle, and 20 other elections on a two-year cycle. That's a lot of elections, especially when you consider, and this always is something worth noting, I think, out of Minnesota's 87 counties, only 9 counties have full-time, year-round election personnel devoted just to elections. As many of you know from your own districts, or you just know it, in most of Minnesota, the person in charge of elections at the county election county level wears a lot of hats. That person probably also does property taxes, also does certain inspection work, also does ditch and drainage issues. So that person wears a lot of hats. And unlike, say, Hennepin County, where I live, there isn't a full-time, year-round division or staff devoted only to that, full-time and year-round. And so that's a lot to handle for a lot of people. So we work very closely with our local partners in the cities, townships, and counties as well. I want to say a little bit about voter outreach. That is a statutory responsibility since the, I think, 1970s or 80s for us to educate the public about voting and encourage people to use their right to vote. We partner with organizations around the state to make sure that Minnesotans know how to determine their eligibility, register to vote, and vote. I just want to give you a few examples of that work just to give you a flavor. So one of the things we do is we work closely with those in the disability community. We meet quarterly with the Disability Advisory Committee in our office to seek their counsel and guidance and work with them to see how we can make elections in Minnesota easier for voters with a disability. We just had a meeting about a week or so ago. Another area of focus for us has been youth civic engagement. No big shocker or surprise. In Minnesota and everywhere else I know in America, young people vote at far lower rates than the rest of us. And by young, let's say ages 18 to 24 in particular, those first 6 years of eligibility. So one of the things we decided to do was get good habits started early. We started something called Ballot Bowl, which is what it sounds like. It's a competition among college campuses to register voters. We've had reports from a couple campuses, shocker, college Democrats and Republicans actually working together to get their school total up for voter registrations, which I think is a great thing. We had 68 colleges and universities, two-year, four-year, public, private, working together last election. We also went into high schools with the first ever mock election for high school students. We typically isolate it to one contest. It was governor last time, president of the United States 2 years ago, and we started out thinking and hoping, okay, let's shoot for 100 high schools. Sounds good. It's a round number. It's triple digit. It's memorable. Instead, we got nearly 300 high schools participating. That first year in 2016, about 90,000 ballots. In the election just ended in 2018, we upped that to 130,000 ballots to high school students. And what's very interesting about the results, it's not on the slide, is they very much mirror their parents, frankly. In 2016, in the presidential election, it was a paper-thin victory in the mock election for Hillary Clinton, just as it was a paper-thin victory statewide for Hillary Clinton. So we work with a lot of partners. We work with the sports community, all of the professional sports teams, et cetera, and the business community. I think at last count, we had a relationship of some kind with 153 chambers, nonprofit organizations, other corporations. We had 35 of the 50 largest private sector employers in Minnesota working with us on nonpartisan voter outreach in Minnesota. And, of course, we work very closely with military service members and their families to make them aware of how they can vote while serving our country. That's very important work as well. The numbers, just in brief, there were, as you can see for yourself, about north of 3.5 million registered voters out of more than 4 million eligible. So that comes down to an 86.8% registration rate, not turnout rate, but registration rate. About 2.6 million voted, landing us at number one in the country at 64.25%. Interestingly, about 638,000 voted by mail or absentee. This number, for those of you who have been in this space for a while, Mr. Chair, you and others, this is really remarkable. So before this legislature passed the No Excuses Absentee Voting Law in 2013, when you needed an excuse to vote absentee, you needed to swear under penalty of perjury that you were either too sick or disabled or you were going to be out of town that day, the typical rate of absentee voting was 8 or 9% in the typical election in Minnesota. In the election just ended, it was 24%. What that tells me is people love this. They really love this. And so I often say now the way to think about election day is not the day that you vote. It's the last day that you vote. We have a 46-day absentee ballot period, and increasingly Minnesotans are saying, I don't necessarily want to vote on a given day, at a given place, during given hours. I want to vote the day before, the week before, 2 weeks before. And this demonstrates that they really like that option. I want to give a quick thanks here to election judges. If anyone here has ever been an election judge or knows someone who has, bless you or bless them. It takes, as you can see, 28,700 people to run an election in this state, and they don't do it to get rich or for their health. Yes, there's a stipend involved, but it's a long day, as many of you know, and it's a real service. And we need them, and we need them to be sharp, and we need them to be well-trained. Otherwise, we just can't put on a state election. So it's thanks to them and people who work in polling places across Minnesota that we're able to execute elections in Minnesota the way we do. I think that says a lot about our state. Just a few more numbers here. You can see that about 168,000 voters requested a regular absentee ballot. 8,000 more requested a military or overseas ballot. We had 142,000 people who used the online voter registration application at mnvotes.org to seek to register to vote. About a little more than half of those were new. That's something that sometimes gets lost in the voter registration numbers. Not everyone who registers to vote is a new voter. It could be you or me or a friend or neighbor who moves down the street or across the state. You got to re-register. So some people conflate the two sometimes, and I can see why it's easy to do. But a little over half were new people. The rest were people just refreshing what they already had. As you can see, 2018 was a really good year, I think, for democracy in Minnesota in terms of participation, in terms of the numbers. It's the second year in a row, second election in a row, that we were number one in the country in turnout.
Secretary Simon, before we go on, a couple of questions. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, congratulations on maintaining the number one ranking for voter turnout for a second election in a row. If I recall, the election before that, we were number five, and so it's great to get that number one rank back. curious about your thoughts on how we continue to improve voter participation. I noted you rolled out some proposals recently. You're investing in democracy.
Right.
Proposal. I'm interested in how you think we can maintain that number one rank and not slip back again.
Yeah, well, we certainly can't, whatever our rank, except we can't let us. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Long. I'm rusty here.
so am I.
thank you for that. No matter what, we just can't let Wisconsin beat us, right, whether we're first or 49th. But no, seriously, I think there are a number of things. Some of them have to do with laws, and candidly and frankly, some of them don't. In terms of legislation, I think there are things we can do to make it easier for eligible voters to vote. One of the things I'm particularly interested in, and I hope everyone will keep an open mind about, is something that's taken hold in 15 other states and the District of Columbia on a bipartisan basis, signed by governors of both parties, passed by legislatures of both parties, is what's commonly referred to as automatic voter registration, although that's a little bit of a misnomer. There's not that much automatic about it. It's no more automatic than our current system is. All it would really do in Minnesota is reverse the presumption we have now. We have a motor voter law in Minnesota where when you go to renew a driver's license, you take the iChart test, you do everything you got to do, and there's a box you can check, if you've ever noticed, that says, check here if you also want this information to double as your voter registration information, because it's the same information. You have to opt in to check the box. All this would do is reverse that presumption. There would also be a box, but instead it would say, please check the box if you don't want to be registered to vote. That's it. That's all automatic voter registration is. So there's nothing particularly automatic. And then, regardless of the current system or that system, there's nothing automatic about it in the sense that then and only then do you go through the filtering and the screening and the checking and the processing and the comparing against databases, various kinds that our office and local governments do. So that's really all there is to it. I mean, the name automatic voter registration makes it sound far more sweeping than it really is. In Minnesota, it would just be same form, same deal, same checks, same filters, same process, but just reversing the presumption. And that would make our voting rolls more accurate. It gets more people into the system earlier instead of relying as much on same-day voter registration, for example. I would predict that if we enacted this, instead of having 300-some thousand people register to vote on game day, on election day, I have to think it would be roughly an 80 or 90% cut in that, because people in their daily lives would have been in the system before election day where you can do more of the things that I just mentioned. So I don't want to take up too much of the committee's time, but that's one example of what other states I think have realized and I believe in my judgment would make sense for us. And then just a nod to what I said before, you know, I'm a realist too, and all of you are as well. Some of this isn't about passing laws, because there's a segment of the population out there, we all know them, we've all door-knocked them. They don't want to vote. They're not interested in it. They don't think it affects them. They don't think it's relevant. They don't trust the system. And I don't know that you can necessarily legislate around that. That's just about good old-fashioned contact and having conversations with folks. So I think it's a combination of things in Minnesota. There's much more to say, but not enough time to say it.
Representative Long. Representative Claiborne.
Mr. Chair, members, my question has to do with a conversation I had while door knocking and then with the disabilities community. There is concern about the age of the voting equipment for the blind. Do you have any information about what type of equipment? I think it's called AutoMark. I don't remember exactly. AutoMark. Is there any plan to help people maintain their privacy while voting with new equipment? Thank you.
Yes.
Secretary Simon, I know we've had this the last couple of years.
We've had, yes. And I'll try to be quick in respect of all your time and the committee's time. Mm-hmm. But, yes, that's a big issue, one that I hadn't planned to talk about, and I'm sure it'll come up in other contexts. This is a big issue. So some of you who were here may remember that all of you, and thank you for that, on a bipartisan basis, passed legislation in 2017 provide some new money for elections equipment for our counties, for our cities, for our townships. And that's great. And all those localities got that money, and thank you for that. Here's the problem. So 80 out of 87 Minnesota counties have chosen, because we don't command and control from St. Paul, every county gets to choose which vendor they go for. It just so happens that 80 out of 87 counties have chosen one particular vendor. I'm not going to name the vendor. That's their choice, not ours. We certify equipment. They can choose whatever brand they want. They've chosen this vendor. The problem in the election space is you can't buy, so every precinct in Minnesota has to have two kinds of equipment, the regular ballot counting equipment that most of us are familiar with, and under federal law, there's a second piece of equipment that every precinct in America has to have, which is assistive voting technology.
Thank you.
Not only for those who are blind, but who have a disability. So two pieces of equipment, every precinct in Minnesota, one by state law, one by federal law. As to the disability equipment, you get in this vendor problem, and the vendor problem is this. You can't, in this space, buy one piece of equipment from one vendor and mix and match and one from another. And what has happened in Minnesota is 80 out of 87 counties have chosen vendor A for their regular ballot tabulating equipment, which means that if they want to replace the AutoMark, which is 20-year-old technology, does not work well, arguably was never super great for assistive voting technology, they have to be able to purchase from that vendor. The problem is, to do that, we need to pass a statute. We need a statutory change in Minnesota that we've been working on for 2 years to enable those counties to buy the equipment they need to replace the old stuff, 80 of the 87 counties at least. We can't do that unless we pass a statute enabling certification of that equipment. It's a long story. I can get into it with you offline or any member of the committee offline. Mm-hmm. This is not a partisan issue. It sailed through the House last year, I think, with 126 votes out of 134. The problem, frankly, has been in the Senate, not in the House, and it's not a partisan issue. And so we're working on resolving that logjam this year.
Thank you.
Representative Claybar. Mm-hmm. Representative Lippert.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Secretary, I represent 20B, which is a largely rural district, and three of the townships in my district were mail-in-only townships for voting. And my understanding was that there was difficulty both finding election judges in these townships and upgrading technology was also something that they chose not to do, so they chose to do mail-in-only. I'm curious if you have information on the rate of participation in these townships, if it mirrored other kind of mail-in trends, and if you expect this sort of trend to continue in rural townships across the state.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lippert, great question. And just as a refresher, or this may be new for some, we have about 55,000 people in Minnesota who live in jurisdictions that vote only by mail. Why? Because we have a law on the books here in Minnesota, we have had since the late 80s, that allows all non-metro townships, which is a lot of townships, regardless of size, and all cities in Minnesota that are 400 or fewer registered voters, not people. So all non-metro townships and all cities that have 400 or fewer voters, if they choose, they can ditch polling places and vote only by mail. And we have about 55,000 people who fall into that. Sounds like some of your constituents as well. Mm-hmm. There is some evidence that those jurisdictions that have gone to all mail have higher voter turnout. It's certainly correlation. I don't know if it's causation, but it's certainly correlation. It certainly looks like that when you look at the map. But even apart from that, there are more small cities that want to do this, but they're too big. And so you're going to see legislation, some of you this year from the League of Minnesota Cities and others, that ups that cap, which hasn't been changed in 30 years, from 400 to something else. I don't know what the something else will be. But we literally, in Kitson County, there is a city that has something like 417, 418 people. They'd love to do it. It's expensive to maintain a polling place. As I mentioned, two pieces of equipment, probably about $10,000 a polling place. If you're a small community, that could be a budget buster. And so they want to do it, but they're too big. On the other side, you have the city of Lutzen, the resort town on the North Shore, that has had it for years, loves it, and will soon probably bust 400 people. So they're going to grow out of the reform that they've passed and that they want. They're going to be forced to buy elections equipment that they don't particularly want and have a polling place they don't particularly want because they've grown too large, over 400 registered voters. So it's time, I think, to up that cap to what, I'm not sure, but that legislation will likely be before you members.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Secretary, I was just want to say I was impressed when I was talking with voters in these townships that they were aware that this was happening. So clearly communication happening about voter registration or these voter changes was happening, and I was impressed by that. So I just want to thank you for that.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, so congratulations on the high turnout that we have here in Minnesota. And my question is based on the no excuse absentee voting, that the percentage went up so much. And I think I know that door knocking, I heard from a lot of people how happy they are that that's an option for them. And I come from the city's perspective, as you know, and so my question is about the impact on cities and the cost to cities for that. And so I know that you just acquired a new director of elections and took him from the city of Minnetonka, where I come from, and I think he's going to do a great job, and I'm glad that he'll be representing the city perspective at the Secretary of State's office. My question is, are you hearing from cities that there are a cost implication, and are there other impacts that cities are feeling due to that? I think it's 45-day no excuse absentee. Yeah. So just wondering if you're hearing anything.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Acom. Yes. So costs are tricky when it comes to absentee voting. There are ways that it can cost more. There are ways that it can cost less. If I might make a suggestion, one thing that would, if we're just talking about money and nothing else, and I understand there are values debates about this all the time, if we're just talking about money, one thing that would really help cities, counties, and townships when it comes to absentee voting is to allow what many other states have, which is to allow people to put themselves on a list so that without having to fill out another form every 2 years and another application for an absentee ballot, they can just be marked as, you know, every election, will you please just send me the ballot so I can be on that list. That saves a tremendous amount of time, aggravation, hassle, and yes, also money. Another thing that saves money that the legislature has done, and thank you for it, but extending it might be a good idea, is we now have a law on the books that allows counties and cities, at their option, they don't need to, it's totally up to them, we don't tell them what to do, but if they want to, during that final 7 days of in-person absentee voting, as opposed to mailing it in, but in-person, it's more like a game day experience. As some of you know, if you've voted absentee, you have to fill out that ballot there. Let's say you do it in person at a city hall. You have to put that in an envelope. You have to put that envelope in a second envelope, and then you hand it to someone who's just going to take it anyway, and maybe 30 seconds later, open the envelope. And so what the legislature did, and thank you for that a couple years ago, is to say, okay, in the 7 days before the election, you don't need all the envelope business. It feels a lot like game day. You go in there, you vote absentee at Minnetonka City Hall, let's say, and you don't have to do the envelope business. If that were extended past 1 week, and there have been various pieces of legislation here to do that, including one that would do it for the entire 46 days for in-person absentee at a county or city, that too would save a lot of time, money, hassle for those who administer absentee voters, voting process.
Representative Acom.
Thank you.
I have one question along that same line with the early voting period. It was raised yesterday or the day before at school board. We had a meeting with the school board and school officials from Robbinsville School District, and they raised the fact that with referendums, they're prohibited by law from putting out information before October, I think it is. Yeah. And that's after the 45-day period when people are actually voting. And that was a concern that they had. And I don't know if we need to have an answer now, but I just wanted to raise it to your attention that they're saying that, well, people are voting, and they're voting on this referendum, but we can't give them the information until, I think it's 21 days after the voting opens. So it's was a situation was raised with us, and figured I'd raise it to you since you're here. Representative Quam, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And did we take care of this bit of business?
We're going to do that in a second. Yeah.
Okay. I've got a couple of requests for information and clarification. Because of the previous questioning that your office can't do anything about somebody fraudulently coming in and updating a registration for a business, and you're going to get some information to the representative on that. I noticed in the previous slide that you had 50,000 updates to the online updates to the registration. I'd like to have passed on the information, maybe the whole committee could see it, of what protections you have, because it seems as if for part of your function there's nothing you said you office can do to protect against fraud and updates for businesses, that registration. I'd like to know what you can and are doing to prevent the same type of fraud in an update to the registration for voting. Another thing is, and it's somewhat related, there was an election judge that was going to be working 12 hours, which is not that uncommon in some of the smaller rural areas. And during training for the election judge, they asked, well, what if I recognize the same person coming in and saying they're a different person? And the trainer told them, let them vote. I'd like clarification maybe on the training and also on that issue of what is allowed if you happen to see something. Now to the question, about 10 months ago, you may recall the legislative auditor had a report on a 2016 registration, and there were tens of thousands of bad registrations. And during the discussion for the verifications and determination and disposition of those, it became evident that there was a gap for the SSA where they match the last four, Social Security, the name, and et cetera. And we were going to get further clarification. That didn't happen during the session. I corresponded to try and get that information, because was it 15,000-16,000 mismatches? It was about 10% that were sent into the SSA for that voting election cycle. Didn't really know what the dispositions of those were, and that was not a trivial quantity. The response I got was, that's the counties. And so I took 15 counties, which most of the top 10 population, plus a few counties to get geographical and also different size. And the counties responded that they did not have access to the data and couldn't perform that function. And so it's sort of in limbo. If nobody is responsible for voter integrity and the verification and disposition of tens of thousands of registrations that issue, do we have a gap? To me, that begs to election integrity concerns. So if you did have a responsive whose responsibility, the buck stops here type statement, and then I wouldn't mind having the actual disposition request that was made earlier.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, there's a lot to take on there in that question. Why don't I do this, and I'm happy to talk with you further offline and get you the information. I just went to the previous slide. You're referring to the new registrants. I'm sorry, 77,108 were new registrants, 57 and change were updates, and you were asking for information. We can get you some of that information offline. But as to that last issue, the Social Security, I know what you're talking about, and that's something that the Office of Legislative Auditor, cooperating with us, is looking into. But the Social Security Administration itself has done a really thorough and, I think, very good report on this. And that number that you reference is not a number of people. It's the number of submissions. So if a particular county submitted a name saying, wait a minute, this isn't a match, what's going on, and submitted it six times, that's counted. So sometimes it's a multiple of 5 or 6 or 10. Not only that, what the Social Security Administration basically said in this report is, please don't use this data as evidence of someone who is ineligible to register. Why? Because in the vast majority of cases, it's either a mistranscription of the number or, even worse, they have, as they've warned, an exact match system at the Social Security Administration, exact match. So if it's Michelle with one L's or two L's, or someone forgets the apostrophe in O'Donnell, or someone leaves off a letter, or someone misspells, that can be flagged as well. It's not just somebody putting in a false Social Security number. So what happens in those instances is, under state law, every single one of those cases must. There's no discretion. There's no, I'm too busy, don't have time, sweeping it under the rug. Must be looked at, must be uncovered, must be followed up, must be investigated. And if someone at the local level, at the county level typically, sometimes cities, if they can't resolve it, then it must, no discretion, must be forwarded to law enforcement for investigation, potential prosecution, and conviction. And so what we then get on the other end, and we now change it to make it even more rigorous, we will now, going forward, get two reports a year. The next one's coming up in April, so we'll have a lot more to tell you in April. The next one's in the fall, either September or October. Every jurisdiction in Minnesota, law enforcement jurisdiction in the counties, has to report to us twice a year, whether it's an election year or not, all of that information, you know, on chargings, on convictions, what the conviction was for, on anything related to voter registration. It could be Social Security. It can be anything else. It could be voter impersonation. It could be someone walking into the polling place claiming they're you and they're not you voting, and they have to report to us. So we'll know a lot more in April based on the 2018 election, and that will encompass not just Social Security issues, everything. So I'll have more to tell you about the numbers, particular numbers for the 2018 election in April, but I'm happy to talk with you offline about any and all of this.
Mr. Chair,
thank you, Mr.
The SSA report you're referring to is a decade old. There's been great improvements to their system, especially because of the national security effort to improve things so that their system is much improved. I would not be... I understand what you're saying, but the concern comes from you've got the legislative auditor looking through your records and talking to your people to try and get the data on the verification, and that data wasn't available to the professional auditors that actually have, by agreement, access to more in-depth data than is generally accessible. And that's where my concern comes in. And so I eagerly await, you know, more detailed information. But there's a big chalk dust, fuzzy gray hole of where that wasn't covered in the audit because they couldn't get the data. And thank you.
Mr. Simon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, just a quick response to that. I don't think it's because they couldn't get the data. I will tell you, we gave them the keys to the car. When the OLA comes calling to anyone, we just said, here are the keys, take it for a spin, do whatever you want. They had access to every morsel of data that we have, and have no restrictions, nothing. So I don't think it's fair to say that they couldn't get the data or that they weren't allowed to have access to the data. It may be, and my impression from them is, it's going to take some time to sort of unwind what they did get, compare it against data from the counties, and they're going to do some sort of supplemental thing. But I don't want it said that our office somehow was not forthcoming or our office didn't provide them everything they asked for and more. They got the keys to the car. They got absolutely everything, and will continue to.
Representative Quam, if we can get it quickly, another
question. Absolutely. I want to apologize. I wasn't inferring that you didn't give them the data, and then I mentioned that they had access to some stuff that's fairly restricted. The point is, and I, being on the Legislative Audit Commission, I spoke with them before the report came out and after the report came out, and the problem was they looked at the data and there wasn't the data to be able to reassure that that verification had been done, and the people and citizens of the state need that reassurance, and that's why we've got the auditor function.
You can finish up your reports.
Yes, I'll be quick, members, and happy to stop for questions. But the administrative part of the office includes the open appointments process. We do the intake. We don't make the appointments. As you know, the governor makes the appointments. We do the intake and the processing for 230 boards, councils, agencies, et cetera. We certify official documents. We and I serve on the Executive Council, the State Board of Investment, the Board of the Minnesota Historical Society. And, of course, we work as sort of a constituent services office on a lot of issues with state, federal, and local election officials as well. Here's just a snapshot of our website. We revamped and redid the website 4 years ago. It was just a static, almost like a Word document online, not very helpful or useful. Now you can do searching. Not only can you see a snapshot of each board and commission, you can see whether there's per diem, you can see who's on it, you can see everyone's application. So everyone who's ever applied for a board or commission in the state, their application is now available online. A quick word, and it's too bad that it's quick, about something that is very, very important, that work that our office does, and those of you who are new either to the committee or to the legislature might not know about. We run a program called the Safe at Home program. Safe at Home is an address anonymity program for victims of domestic violence, stalking, and others who fear for their safety. It was enacted by the legislature in 2006, put in place in 2007, and it's designed to protect people. And one of the things we do is we handle people's mail. They, by being in the program, are basically shielding and keeping secret and private for all purposes their true physical residential address. No one other than the person enrolled in the program and whoever they choose to tell and us knows where they actually live. And this is to protect them, and this is to protect their children from harm or worse. And so the address that they have is a P.O. box in St. Paul. No matter where they live in the state, they have a unique lot number within that P.O. box. And so we receive that mail, repackage it, and forward to them on a daily basis. We partner with 82 social service agencies to support participants. And participation has increased a lot, as you'll see, from less than 200 in the first year to over 2,700 now. And I will tell you that's a bittersweet statistic. Yeah. On the one hand, how great that there's a program out there that provides an umbrella of protection for people at the worst point in their life when they fear for their safety or their lives and the lives of their children. But on the other hand, how sad it is that that many people need this kind of remedy. And I think you'd agree, it's an unusual remedy to basically make your home address completely secret for all purposes, public and private. But there you go. There's the demand as it exists right now. As you can see, we're in multiple jurisdictions in the state, 89 jurisdictions, all counties, and a couple of Native American Indian communities as well. And you can see the growth through the years. Again, bittersweet statistics as more and more people are taking advantage of this service. You can read these for yourself. We're very proud of them. These are some of the testimonials from people in the program. It's not an exaggeration to say that this program saves people's lives, period. So we're very proud of that, and I thank you, all of you who have been here before, for your strong bipartisan legislative support of this program. That's all I have. I know you have others on deck. I'm the opening act for the campaign finance board.
In 1 second, we have one more question. Representative Elkins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to respond. There were questions earlier about the security of the business records, and I do not currently have a business registered with the state, but I have in the past, and I went through my list of accounts, and I do in fact have a user ID and password for access to my business records on the Secretary of State's website. So if people are getting into somebody's account and changing the information without their knowledge, it means that their account's been hacked because somebody has stolen their password.
Representative, or Senator Simon, or Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Elkins. Yeah, that's right. It's a national issue for the same reason that other cybersecurity things are national issues, is the bad guys are always looking for a way around all those precautions. We do have those precautions. We do have those protections. The bad guys get smarter every year. And so to Representative Hertaus's point, which is a good and fair one, we need to figure out nationally, all of us who do this, better ways of keeping the bad guys out.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony. And
thank you.
I see this is bipartisan legislation with coming forward to maybe fix that if it needs legislation.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And for those who don't know, our office is right upstairs on the first floor of the State Office Building. I'm available to any of you if you want, by yourself or in groups, to talk to me or any of our staff. We're here for you. We're in the same building. Don't be a stranger. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And while we're switching, I'll invite Mr. Sigurdsson's up to the board. But while we're doing that, Representative Long, have you had any opportunity to read the minutes?
Yes, I have.
Would you like to make a motion to approve the minutes?
I'd be happy to. I move to approve the minutes.
We don't need to second things in committee, but that's motion's been made to approve the minutes for the meeting of January 15th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes have been approved. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. When you're ready, can you state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'll do a quick introduction. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I've been in that position since September 1st of 2016. Prior to that, I joined the board as the Assistant Director in 2000, so 16 years of service prior to becoming executive director. And then prior to that, I worked at the Secretary of State's office in their election division for 12 years. So If you do the quick math, you'll be like me and surprised to find that I've been with the state for 31 years. Nonetheless, it does allow me to have some perspective on
Sir, can you pull the mic a little closer?
Sure. Apologize. I know you have time restrictions, so I'm going to do a very quick walkthrough of the overview of the board and then talk about a couple of change items which the board has asked me to bring forward to this committee. Basically, just to remind you that the board's mission is to build public confidence in state government through administration of the various disclosure and campaign finance programs that's under its jurisdiction. There are three primary programs, campaign finance, lobbying, and economic disclosure, which I'll cover shortly. But we do believe that the board's goal, again, is to make the public confident in the actions of the state, in particular of state public and elected officials. And that is, in fact, the goal, to make sure that the citizens of the state believe that they are being represented fairly and understand the process. The board is an independent agency. The board does not report to the governor's office, although our overall budget request will be included in their recommendations. As I mentioned at the end of the presentation, I have two quick change items which I'm going to review with you. Although they may or may not be included in the governor's recommendation or overall budget, we are an independent agency, and the board does ask me to bring these financial concerns to your committee's attention. The board consists of six members. No more than half the members may come from any one party. At least two members are former legislators, one from each party. Members are appointed by the governor, but we are somewhat unique in that not only the Senate approves or confirms our appointments, but also the House does as well. And so the policy committee for the board will have those two members coming before it this year. The board has a staff of 9 full-time positions, and again, we administer 3 programs. Through the administration of those programs, the first and probably the one that you are most familiar with is, of course, the campaign finance program, as you are all registered entities under that program. The board administers Chapter 10A and certain provisions of Chapter 211B regarding disclaimers, corporate contributions, and expenditures made with any money raised for a political purpose. Those same provisions in Chapter 211B are administered by the Office of Administrative Hearings for local-level candidates. Again, we are limited to state-level candidates, political committees, political funds, and party units. There are 700 candidate committees typically registered with the board at any one time. Obviously, we have registrations and terminations occurring at all times, but approximately 700 candidates, 340 political committees and funds, and 320 political party units. We also have a new entity starting in 2010, which is the Independent Expenditure Committees and Funds, which are regulated rather differently than other entities registered with the board, and there are 70 now independent expenditure committees and funds. During an election year, we're going to process 4,800 reports, and then we'll have hundreds of amendments and hundreds of 24-hour notices of large contributions received during certain periods during an election year. The next report coming up on January 31st for all of your committees. To assist in this sort of intense reporting requirement that has to reflect all of the provisions of Chapter 10A, which is admittedly a complicated chapter, especially for volunteer treasurers, the board has developed free software that it provides to all registered committees. The Campaign Finance Reporter software not only generates all the necessary report, but very key element of that software is that it also does compliance checking on all data entries. So it looks for excess contributions, it looks for excess expenditures for candidates, and remember, this is over now a 2-year period, so it's looking at not only the entry for 2018 in the last election cycle, if your committee was active in 2017, it goes back and looks at that period as well. It also does the special source calculations. That, we think, is key because the volunteer treasurers, who I think are sort of the unsung heroes of administering your campaigns, it's a lot for them to ask to keep track of all the contributions that are coming in smaller amounts, aggregating those together, and then, oh yes, by the way, go do it for the prior year and make sure that you haven't gone over the contribution limit or that you have other problems with the contribution coming in. So again, the software helps us eliminate errors by your treasurer, eliminate violations, and make the process run smoother. Nonetheless, we, of course, also conduct a lot of training classes. We have compliance training classes, which are for the treasurers and candidates so that they understand the basic provisions of Chapter 10A and understand how what the software is trying to do for them. And then separately, we have training classes on the use of the software. Basically, or I should say formally, most of that training occurred in St. Paul, frankly, for convenience sake and because we only have a staff of nine. But during an election year, we do get out to greater Minnesota. I believe we had eight compliance set training classes throughout the state in 2018. And a personal commitment I have is to maybe not offer eight, but at least offer two or three training classes in greater Minnesota, even during a non-election year, because we do know that committees are always formulating, always getting up and running for the next election, and we need to have a better, I guess, a better profile in those committees that can't easily get to St. Paul. We do, of course, the board does, of course, do more than just collect and disclose reports. We also do enforce the provisions of Chapter 10A and 211B that the board has authority over. These are through investigations, and the board may impose various civil penalties for violations. The investigations start either through complaints that are filed with the board or through staff review of documents filed with the board. Now, we're just getting in the year-end reports, and frankly, we find some violations in those reports. But so far, the board has completed 29 investigations based on activities at the 2018 election. So there is, again, a regulatory process that the board also undertakes. The board also administers the public subsidy program. In 2018, the board issued payments totaling $2,257,000 to 245 qualified House and constitutional candidates. That's roughly 91% of the candidates who filed for office. So increasingly, or I should say consistently, the public subsidy program is a program that candidates for all political parties participate in. It allows them access both to the public subsidy program if they payment if they qualify under various conditions of the public subsidy agreement. But also, very importantly, once you sign the public subsidy agreement, you, of course, have immediate access to the political contribution refund program, which is, again, a very popular program with candidates in terms of raising funds. The contributions and expenditures reported to the board continues to grow. The example that I tend to focus on, because, frankly, it's the most dramatic, is the increase of independent expenditures. There is a chart that I've provided in the handout, and I realize it's difficult to read because of the small font. But basically what it's showing you that is in 1994, party units spent a grand total of $8,200 in independent expenditures for all candidates in the state. In 2016, that amount just for political parties had grown to $7,393,000. Further, in 2010, because of the Citizens United case, independent expenditure committees and funds that can only make independent expenditures and therefore can receive funding sources that are not available to other types of political committees and funds came into existence. And now, the last election that we have for full members, 2016, they spent $11,839,000. The total amount that was spent just through the pre-general report for 2018, and again, that doesn't include the year-end report, but the pre-general report already shows $23,371,000 in independent expenditures on state-level candidates. That's a record for any election held in Minnesota. So it is, again, just an example, and this is not really looking at independent expenditures in a positive or negative way. It's just to show that the amount of money and the amount of disclosure and therefore regulation that the board is undertaking for these elections continues to grow. The next program that I'd like to briefly go through is the lobbying program. Lobbyists do register with the board on behalf of principals that wish to influence official actions of public officials and certain local officials. We have a limited definition of lobbying in Minnesota. There are basically four actions that come under that heading. Legislative action, excuse me, which of course includes asking you to have an official action on a piece of legislation. That also includes asking the governor to support or oppose legislation. The adoption of administrative rules, which is actually the only type of activity or communication with an executive branch agency or with an agency that has the authority to adopt administrative rules that is covered by the lobbying function. Any activity before the Public Utilities Commission, which involves the setting of rates or the granting of permits, and then the actions of a limited number of cities, 17 cities with a population of over 15,000 in the metro area, and the seven county boards within the metro area. Minnesota is also a grassroots lobbying state, which means that it isn't only direct communication with the public officials. If you buy a billboard or something to that effect that says, you know, contact your legislator and ask them to vote for fill in the blank, that is also grassroots lobbying, and that's included in the reports that we receive in terms of as an expenditure by the lobbying entities. The board, as a part of that jurisdiction over the lobbying program, also enforces the gift prohibition between lobbyists and public officials. There's approximately 1,450 lobbyists registered with the board at any one time, and they represent about 1,400 associations, which we call principals, that have hired lobbyists to be represented in Minnesota. The lobbyists report twice a year, the principals report once a year, and then the bar chart, the chart that you see there on the amount that's being reported by principals again shows, although not as dramatically, that again the amount of money that's being reported and regulated by the board continues to go up. You see in 2012 the total amount spent on lobbying was about $62.5 million, and in 2017, 5 years later, it's $75.6 million. A lot of that does relate to the spikes and valleys that you see through the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. For example, in 2017, the $9,800,000 before them, almost all related to the Line 3 issue. I expect that in 2018, you'll continue to see a lot of funds being spent on that issue. But again, the general trend is that the amount of money being spent on lobbying in Minnesota continues to grow, and the number of lobbyists registered with the board continues to grow. The third program is the Economic Interest Program. This is the program in which public officials provide the board with information on employment and investments that may, under certain circumstances, create a conflict of interest with the actions that they take as a public official. It's made available to the public so that there can be, again, confidence that those actions were not done in such a way as to personally benefit the public official who took a particular vote. It isn't just members of the legislature and their staff who are public officials. There are approximately 3,440 public officials that filed in 2018, and that there are over 369 state offices, boards, agencies, and commissions where their members, or at least part of their membership, are required to file economic interest statements with the board. Again, all this information is available on our website and can be sorted either by individual or by agency if you want to have an overview of the type of interest that may be on any particular commission or board. There are basically two types of filings under the Economic Interest Program. The original statement is filed at the time an individual is appointed to an agency, or if you're filing for office, then you file one of those within 14 days of filing for office. I believe there are six first-time members on this committee. That would be your only filing. You are not required to do the annual certification. The rest of the members should be filing their annual certification by January 28th, and that's where you review any, to see if there's any changes that you need to make to your system, to your statement. That's all online. We are pleased that about 99% of public officials did the certification last year online, which of course reduces rather dramatically the amount of paper that needs to be shuffled, and we hope makes it easier for people to do this at a more convenient location for them. Again, the number of public officials required to file with the board has increased. It's not as dramatic as the other programs, but because of statutory changes that have periodically brought in county commissioners, judges, and prior to that, soil and water conservation district members and water organizations, you can see that we've gone from about 2,800 public officials in 2015 to about 3,400 members in 2018. Again, it's not an overwhelming increase, but you have to understand that when we get, it isn't just getting the report, we are then notified of any appointment or hiring by the Attorney General's office for certain positions, and then we in turn have to go out and contact that individual and explain to them the requirement to file an economic interest statement, and then also the time frame in which it has to be done. There are three documents that I provided in the handout. The first is the agency profile, which is already a public document that's available. It goes through the funding that's available to the agency. The one thing that I have found in the past, which is sometimes a matter of some confusion, the board's budget for operations is $1,048,000 per year currently, and yet if you look at the report on the profile, on page 5, it looks like we receive another $1,020,000 in all odd-numbered fiscal years. That's actually a pass-through, even though it's coming in on the 1,000 fund. That's money that goes to the state general account for paying public subsidy. It's a statutory appropriation, so it comes in for reasons I'm not entirely clear on the 1,000 level rather than on their special revenue. But at any rate, that is not operational funds. Those are funds, again, for the public subsidy program. And then the bottom of page 5, you'll see the special revenue funds and the carry forward that's required from the checkoff amount that you receive from the tax forms. The $1,048,000, just a brief history there. The last time the board asked for an increase in the operating budget was in 2013. And at that time, the legislature did increase the board's budget to $1 million for fiscal years 14 and 15. We did not ask for any increase in the operating budget in the two subsequent fiscal cycles or bienniums. There were increases that were granted to us by the governor without request. I believe he provided those to all small agencies. So again, after 6 years, the $1 million has gone up to $1,048,000. The problem with that, and it was done with the agreement at the time that the agency would not come back for an increase request when it was increased to $1 million, because the funding was not only to increase board staff. At that time, we had a staff of 7.5, and frankly, we were not able to do all of the functions that we believed we needed to do, and those functions that we did do were often tardy and not really responsive to the public's right to know and as quickly as possible on the information related to campaign finance. So as part of that increased $1 million, staff went to 9 FTE, and then certain funds were spent on improving the technology of the board, in particular the new website, which has the ability to download data directly from the website as opposed to requesting it from staff, and has the ability to do various searches which were not available on the prior website. That website is now done, but because of other increases, and particularly, frankly, staff costs and benefit costs, we now get to the first of the two change item requests, which is a request for a $75,000 per fiscal year to the annual operating budget of the board, which is now, through this request, would be $1,123,000. That represents roughly a 7% increase. It's required for the board to maintain a staff of 9 FTE and to ensure that there are sufficient funds available for other basic agency needs, with a small amount of flexibility at least to meet anticipated changes or problems that may come up. And I think, frankly, that would be the case for any agency. If you look at the little table that I provide you there, in 2014, when we initially went to $1 million, salary and benefits took up 64% of the budget. When you get down to the anticipated salary and benefits as provided to us by MMB in FY 2020 and FY 2021, we're looking at just salary and benefits taking up 89% and 91% of the total appropriation provided to the board for operations. That simply isn't sufficient. When you add in even just the lease that we pay for to the Department of Administration for our office space, you're now at 94 and 95% of the appropriation. And frankly, I'm just not a good enough administrator to do everything else on 5% of the budget. So that's why there's the request for the $75,000 per fiscal year. If, briefly, if the increase does not occur, then we are certainly looking at dropping our FTE from 9 to 8. That would be 11% decrease in our staff. I know when you say, well, you'd only have to cut one person, but with our staff, that's 11%. And that does mean that you would see a slowdown in our ability to respond to volunteer treasurers, our ability to respond to lobbyists who are trying to fill out the report, basically our support for the regulated community, which is based very heavily on picking up the phone and talking to people, would be degraded. I also think that we would, although I'm not exactly sure the impact here, I think it would be very hard to not have that then trickle into how quickly and how accurate the reports are in terms of how they're filed with the board. If you're not able to support treasurers, then perhaps they file anyway and the report is wrong, which then means that the information provided to the public is wrong. So I do think that that one position, although it may not seem very significant, has a very significant impact on the ability for the board to provide timely and accurate information on those three programs that are the ministers. The second, very quickly, the second change item is a $50,000 one-time appropriation to support the transfer of Campaign Finance Reporter, the software I mentioned earlier, from a PC-based program to a web-based program. The majority of that program was initially developed in 1998 with Visual Basic, which is a language that is a programming language which is no longer supported by Microsoft. It's also incapable of operating on an Apple operating system, or much to our horror, we now realize it doesn't work on a Chrome piece or Chrome computer either. So you now have increasingly a number of treasurers who have a machine that simply can't use the software. That means that they do paper reports. That means they no longer have the compliance checking that the software offers. It now means that we now have to data entry those when those reports come in on paper. It's not good. So we need to be in a position where we can support more of our clients and are not tied into a particular version of Windows. Rather, it's going to be browser dependent. And again, the majority of that work is being done by staff. We're fortunate in that we have two dedicated IT staff, one of who, frankly, is an extremely good programmer and who has been supporting the program for about 8 years. So he is now already in the process of developing that as a web-based application. However, it's very timely that we get this done in 2019. The last thing we want to do, obviously, is roll out a new reporting system during an election year. The $50,000 is, I admit, a bit of a lifesaver to me. If I find that we're starting to have a problem in getting this done during 2019, most of the programming is being done in a very modular form. We have already identified areas that we could farm out, allowing our current staff to work on the big issues, but putting out certain parts of the application to an outside vendor to make sure that we are complete in 2019. The attempt to move it to a web-based application occur even if the $50,000 isn't approved? Yes, it will, but I'll be a lot more concerned about our ability to complete that during a non-election year if I don't have that $50,000 available to the board if required. And again, I blew through that very quickly. If there's any questions or you'd like me to go back and elaborate on something, I'm happy to do so.
Representative Albright, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to revert back to just a question about statement of economic interest. We file or update that on an annualized basis as elected officials. It's a matter of personal opinion on my part, but it's always kind of a look back as opposed to a look forward in terms of your review of that. But understanding that there is some ambiguity in terms of it only asks for, to some extent, the statement of economic interest, your participation either as a board of director, an executive, or your financial interest in an entity. It doesn't recognize, and you can correct me on this, if you're representing someone from a legal perspective. And in some cases, with lawyers who also serve in the capacity as an elected official, whether as a senator or as a representative, hearing testimony before a committee certainly might alter the manner in which they might represent a client. And so I'm wondering, two parts to the question. One is, how do you rectify or recognize that anomaly in the system? And two, from a conflict of interest, how does the elected official recognize and recuse themselves in a timely basis and then self-report that to the CFB or others in order to make sure that they are compliant with the statutes and the law as you would see them necessary.
Director. Mr. Chair, Representative, there is, in fact, I think, some areas for improvement in the economic interest disclosure program, one which the board is considering bringing forward to the legislature this year. Dealing with the type of disclosure provided is the question of whether a public official may have a state contract with either the entity that they represent, which occasionally occurs, or at least through their business might have a state contract that could be influenced by one of their actions. So I think there are, the board does recognize that there are some areas to look at. It's also looking at the question of spousal disclosure, not specifying any investments or conflicts that may arise from the spouse separately, but to have that all rolled into one disclosure. I don't know, frankly, if the board will recommend either of those. You may have, I think you have a point. The board has looked at the question of beneficial interest and sort of defined that as the type of situation I believe that you're referring to, and it's difficult. The current this definition of conflict of interest is not only that it may affect you if you take a particular action, but it would affect you more than anyone else in a similar business class. And you know, the example is if you're a farmer, does that mean you can't vote on the agriculture bill? No, it doesn't mean that at all. Although if there was a provision in the agriculture bill that affected only the section of land that you lived in, then that obviously is a different question. So it's the conflict of interest requirement is basically a disclosure requirement to the entity on which the public official serves. For example, for a legislator, the disclosure isn't made to us, it's made to the speaker. And they then take the action of whether or not you should recuse yourself or whether you should go ahead and take action, but at least there's this documentation that there is the possibility of a conflict. And I'm not sure if I exactly addressed your question, but that is the sort of the problems that we're trying to address by improving the disclosure, not to be overly burdensome. As you may recall, at the last session, we in fact changed the type of disclosure you have to, public officials have to provide to exclude mutual funds because the determination was made that that wasn't helpful. But there are other areas that the board is looking at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And before we start, we're running a little bit late here, so if we keep our questions succinct and our answers maybe short also, as short as possible.
Certainly. I know we're not discussing a lot of numbers today, but since it was brought up with an increase, just looking in, you know, the 888 comes out to about $98,000 on average per FTE, which is above what I was seeing last year with all FTEs through all the agencies, plus significantly more than probably average family income. So I realize that we're in need of more money relative to the budget, but I'm wondering why the salary, the compensation would be possibly so much more than maybe other agencies, as well as more than actually the average family income of a Minnesotan.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, I'm not sure I can compare to other state agencies other than to point out that the board, because of the complexity of Chapter 10A, we only have one ASME employee. All the other employees are MAPE employees or management employees. We have three attorneys on staff, and frankly, they have a higher compensation level than you may see for other types of position. When you have a staff of nine and you have three attorneys, I'm not an attorney, but I'm in the management class. Okay, now we are at four out of the nine who are frankly going to be probably compensated at a higher level than the average state employee. So I suspect that that's the reason.
And it should be pointed out that that includes their benefits, vacation time, sick leave, health care, many money going into the pension. It's not just the salary and what they take home on their paycheck.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Representative Vogel.
That's it. Thank you.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. I have both a quick comment and a question. it's been my experience that the software that you've been talking about is clumsy and inefficient, and I certainly would welcome seeing something different. And clearly, most of us who have been here a little while, I think, find it most convenient to maintain a lot of your data on a Excel spreadsheet with regard to contributors and information. It certainly, as you're requesting money for a new software program, it would be really wonderful if it would be easy to just upload an Excel spreadsheet. It would save so much time because it's hard to get people to volunteer to do this. It's such an antiquated program. Every time I've had somebody volunteer to be a treasurer, they don't want to do it after a few weeks, and it takes a lot of time, and it's like a full-time job, which it shouldn't have to be. That said, I don't know how many other states require the level of reporting that we do, but you would almost think that there must be some boxed software that could be used or imported or purchased somewhere in the country other than developing a new one. But those are my comments and my question. I guess, you know, is there something out there that really does work and interface with Apple and Chrome and the other things? But I think it's incredibly cumbersome, and it's a dinosaur that should be killed immediately.
Director. Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess there are several layers of that question as well. I certainly agree that some of the screens that that a treasurer has to work through are not particularly user-friendly. That's certainly something that we intend to improve. I guess I would say that the software, of course, reflects the statute in which it's trying to provide information, both in terms of reports and compliance. It's never going to be an Excel spreadsheet where you just type in things. I just don't think that's what we're going to do. The current software actually has the ability to import from Excel because it's based on an Access database, so you can import. But the complication is that you have to have a format. You have to format your spreadsheet in a way that the database can say, oh, that's what that field is, and bring it in. So I think that what we intend to do is to have, as part of the rollout, a set of spreadsheets that have basically all the formatting in it, so that if you are doing data entry of contributions and you just find it easier to do that way, because the fields will be set up and named in a particular way that the database can identify, then it's much easier to just move it back in into the Access database. So I do think that that we'll be able to be more friendly in terms of importing data from other sources.
Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, I guess I'll just make a comment. I know my treasurers have used, whenever they have a question, they call over to the office, and there's usually somebody to answer it, like, right away and get back to them. So I just really appreciate the help that's provided.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try and make this quick. So I had a complaint from a constituent who was about an independent expenditure ad that was run in a municipal election that without a disclaimer and at great expense. And when she called the CFB, she basically was told that, look, we're not staffed to investigate complaints in municipal elections. So the question is, at what level of government, what body do you think should be charged with the responsibility of electing, investigating and prosecuting election violations at the municipal level?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that answer from staff, I would say, was somewhat inaccurate. It isn't a matter of sufficient staffing. It's a matter of jurisdiction. The independent expenditure disclaimer and disclosure is through Chapter 211A, which is outside of the board's jurisdiction for local level candidates and offices. And then that provision about the correct disclaimer on independent expenditure, although it's the same statute, the way it's set up currently is that all of those complaints go to the Office of Administrative Hearing, not to us. So it isn't so much a matter of resources, it's a matter of simple jurisdiction. And so if someone believes that there's an independent expenditure that's not being disclosed or properly identified for a municipal or other local election, they should be contacting the Office of Administrative Hearings currently.
Thank you.
Representative Elkins, any other questions? Well, thank you, Director Sigurdson. And
I think with that, I think we're adjourned.